ladies and gentlemen, dear students. When I was invited here to speak about spiritual foundation of Europe, I felt, of course, very honored to speak about such a high subject. But at the same time, I was puzzled by some uneasy questions, and I will start by sharing some of these uneasy questions. First, can we assume that the post-war European Union is founded on a spiritual commitment? Would it not be more accurate to speak about a materialistic or material foundation of Europe? After all, the post-war integration of Europe is driven by a dream of expanding economic markets and the promise of more economic growth, generating personal as well as collective or social welfare. The political integration always followed the imperatives of globalizing markets and the drive for economic growth, not a path for spiritual progress. How could spiritual values play a foundational role in such an economic-driven process of European integration? That was my first puzzle, and the second one is the following. If we believe that Christian and humanistic values are deeply embedded in Europe's social and cultural past, and that new spiritual ideas and practices coming from Buddhism or Islam or other global religious movements will play a role in the future fabric of European values, how could such a meltpot of spiritualities be a founding source for the future of Europe? So far, my questions. In my brief lecture, I divided my story in three sections. The first part will deal with some failures of the market-driven process of European integration and the potential of a value-driven alternative. In my second part, I will deal with the principle of universal responsibility as a way to overcome European diversity. And in the last part, I will speak about the role of economics in such a value-driven process of integration. Originally, I had also a section on the role of religion, but I will keep it for the written paper because time is limited. So, first section about two ideas of integration. The idea of the European Union originated from the post-war shared will to secure an everlasting peace across the continent. The founding fathers of post-war Europe were deeply committed to peace, but their strategy for peace was not based on spiritual ideas or practices, but on economic integration and cooperation. Looking in a retrospect, it's fair to say that the European concept of peace through economic cooperation has been a very successful model to guarantee an enduring period of peace for our continent. However, this post-war European model is under pressure because some of its assumptions are challenged. And let me remind some of those challenges. The first one is the global challenge. As we all know, the global process deconstructs the national, but also the European boundaries as well. Just think of the recent financial crisis, which originated in the US housing markets, but rapidly was spread out all over the world. The post-war European concept of peace was an effort to avoid nationalistic wars in Europe. A global concept of peace must be an answer to the deeper sources of world conflict today. For instance, the intercontinental competition for energy or other scarce resources. Second, there is an ecological challenge. Economic growth as a way to solve social and political problems and to guarantee welfare and peace for future generations lost some of its evidence. The impact of economic growth on the planet is unsustainable. For instance, in a hypothetical economic growth of 3% in Western countries would double the European GDP in a period of 22 years. Added this to the explosive growth rates of China and other fast-growing countries, this will create unprecedented battle for scarce resources and generate a lot of ecological problems. Although we know this with our minds, and we take some measures to avoid these disasters, the logic of economic growth remains dominant. Who is willing to accept a principle of frugality as an economic device? Three, there is the religious challenge. The assumption that we can reduce religion to the private sphere and run the world by a religion-free economic and political rationality may have some plausibility in Europe, but not on a global scale. Even within Europe, the new migrants reintroduce religion as a factor of social identity and social polarization. This polarization is much more than a clash between faith-based radicalism and secular Western liberalism. In most of the religious families today, we find a strong polarization between the more moderate and the more fundamentalist groups. To overcome this kind of conflicts, the European integration has to offer ways to cope with deep-rooted value conflicts. Europe has to offer a model of tolerant humanism that gives religion its due place. So far, at least, three challenges that deconstruct the post-war European logic of a market-driven integration. That's the idea, the assumption, that this market-driven integration will trigger a political integration which on its turn will generate a context of peace and European cultural identity. What seems necessary in today's context is a reverse sequence where the process starts from a vision on Europe's mission in the global world. You see here in the scheme, it's a bit maybe a simple scheme, because reality offers a more complex picture than the linear scheme suggests. There is always positive and negative feedbacks between the different layers. But the point here is to stress the priority of self-reflection and vision for the future in order to reorient long-term political strategies and economic choices. Without a foundational value orientation and mission, no individuals or communities can make consistent choices, as they will be swayed by the issues of the day and by short time and often opposite expectations from economic and political markets. Europe misses at this moment a value-based leadership that enables people to envision its future role in the globalizing world. However, a value-driven integration project of Europe creates its own problems. If we accept diversity of values as a bottom line for Europe's cultural identity, how can we solve the problem of managing opposite value claims? how to cope with the problem of diversity. In this context, it seems to me very helpful to remind Schumacher's distinction between convergent and divergent problems. Schumacher is the well-known author, well-known maybe for people from my generation, well-known author of the book Small is Beautiful, which was a cult book during the 70s. But at the end of his life, he wrote another book, A Guide for the Perplexed. And I can warmly recommend that book to you. And it's in this book that he made, in the last chapter, the distinction between divergent and convergent problems. Convergent problems are problems that can be designed and solved as technical or rational problems. And at the end, there is only one optimal solution. So when you make a cost-benefit analysis or an optimization procedure, you will find at the end one optimal solution. Divergent problems, on the other hand, are problems that cannot be solved by technical or rational modeling leading to an optimal solution. Schumacher illustrates this with the case of education, where those who are primarily committed to the value of freedom will defend non-authoritarian answers to all educational problems, while people primarily committed to order as the main value will always call for discipline and obedience on the part of the humans. Such divergent value commitments lead to different and often opposite positions. And it's difficult to solve that kind of problems. To quote Schumacher, divergent problems cannot be solved in the sense of establishing a correct formula. They can, however, be transcended. A pair of opposites, in the example it was freedom and order, are opposites at the level of ordinary life, but they cease to be opposites at the higher level, the really human level, where self-awareness plays its proper role. It's then that such higher forces as love and compassion, understanding and empathy become available, not simply as occasional impulses, but as a regular and reliable resource. End of the quote. Applying Schumacher to the European case, this means that to integrate diversity in Europe, or multiculturality in Europe, we must cultivate a higher level of self-reflection and a higher level of value commitment. But saying that we need a higher level of value commitment is not saying what kind of value commitment we need. I believe that the principle of universal responsibility is the key factor in this value commitment. And why focusing on responsibility? Because responsibility is a spiritual commitment, has the potential to stimulate self-reflection, to mobilize our higher capacities such as empathy and compassion, and to transcend blocked polarizations between values such as freedom versus order, freedom versus equality, crowd versus frugality, etc. It would be interesting to disclose how the notion of responsibility has developed during Europe's cultural past, cultural history. But, of course, this would take us too far. I will restrict here myself, and I come now to my second section, to elucidate the distinction between a political and a spiritual interpretation of the principle of universal responsibility. Basic references for international politics, such as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights or the Jus Gentium, do not speak of in terms of responsibilities. They speak in terms of rights. They consider rights as prior to responsibilities. Responsibilities are derivative principles from rights. However, some progressive movements today are pleading for a charter of universal responsibilities. Their plea is based on a common observation. This observation is the following one. People do claim their rights as much as they can, but they are less keen to realize that every right implies a duty or responsibility to protect the rights of other people as well. We prefer people defending their own legitimate rights instead of helping them to realize their rights and to be involved in paternalistic do-good practices. Although responsibilities are recognized theoretically as the other coin of rights, they are not our prime concern. Many social workers call attention to this imbalance between claiming rights and being committed to our responsibilities. Now, in order to overcome this imbalance between rights and responsibilities, I believe that we have to substitute the symmetry thesis, rights and responsibilities are equally founded, by a claim that responsibilities are prior to rights. The problem, however, is that the priority of responsibility over rights does not mesh with the dominant liberal paradigm in political philosophy. It cannot be argued within the framework of liberal political philosophy that defends the symmetry thesis. The philosophical foundation for the symmetry between rights and responsibilities is the liberal and egalitarian concept of the human persons. All persons are equally free. The liberal egalitarian foundation of rights and responsibility can be strengthened by the utilitarian argument that the implementation of universal rights and responsibilities is also beneficial to every person. We all have a profit to respect universal rights and responsibilities. Being unable to foresee and control my future, I will be better protected if I accept minimum standards for everyone. This is the well-known argument of Rawls. And in fact, it's an egocentric argument to promote universal rights under the veil of ignorance and to see rights and responsibilities as part of a social assurance contract to cover the cost of social insecurity. So, yeah. In contrast to this political view, a spiritual approach of responsibility views the foundation of rights and responsibilities as non-symmetrical, non-egalitarian, and non-rational. Non-symmetrical, and I mean by this, duties have priority over rights. Non-egalitarian, and I mean by this, the rights of the other precedes my rights. And non-rational, I mean by this, gratuity has precedence over utility maximization. I cannot explain the whole background of this, but we find one of the most powerful expressions of this approach in the works of the French Jewish philosopher Immanuel Levinas. In contrast to the egocentric approach to responsibility, I do not say the egoistic approach, I do say the egocentric approach to responsibility. He develops an other-centric notion of responsibility. More generally, we can refer to the tradition of spiritual humanism, or in terms of Levinas, the humanism of the other as the philosophical base for claiming the priority of responsibilities over rights. So let me explain a bit the assumptions behind this kind of humanism of the other. The basic assumption of the humanism of the other is the idea that the ego, or the self, is always preceded by the presence of the other. My life, my education, my freedom, my capabilities and my rights are always given before I can appropriate them as part of myself. No one can claim original ownership. Autonomy, only exists as a gift from others, eliciting me to give on my turn real freedom to other people. That's one experience of this priority of the other over the self. But there are other experiences. The experience of gift and its appeal to reciprocity is not the only way to become aware of the priority of the other over the self. In Levinas' view, there is a more radical or traumatic infusion of the presence of the other in the self. The more radical intrigue of the other coincides with the experience of being claimed by the other before I can claim my own rights. Being claimed by the other is not based on physical, emotional, or another external superiority of the other. It is an ethical and spiritual claim expressed through the vulnerability of the human face. Only a powerless, naked human face calling for understanding and respect can infuse in my consciousness an immediate, deep and concrete sense of responsibility that precedes my own goodwill and my own good intentions. Accepting my non-chosen responsibility makes it possible to transform my freedom into a mission at the service of the other. It makes me able of doing things for the other without paternalism. Because the ethical priority of the other implies that I am, first of all, accountable to the other before being responsible for the other. The difference between being accountable, being responsible to the other and for the other looks a bit subtle, but it's crucial for an other-centric notion of responsibility. Caring for the other without being accountable to him runs the risk to reduce the other to an object of my caring, which is paternalism, instead of respecting him as the subject of caring activities. I refer to a third experience, and this revealing the priority of responsibilities over rights, because it's an important idea, I think. And here I refer to the philosophy of Hans Jonas about responsibility for future generations. We often speak about the rights of future generations. Actually, non-existing beings cannot claim rights. Of course, we can imagine them as virtual beings and give them virtual rights. But this is only possible because there is already an intuition of our responsibility to the non-existing future generations. Our gift of rights to them is founded on a primary intuition of responsibility for future life and to the other as the subject of future life. But to conclude this section on responsibility, I give you an example of how different readings of human responsibilities are possible and assume a different value commitment. Here, take the example of Article 3 of the Universal Declaration of Rights, explaining that everyone has the right to life, security, and liberty. Reading this article in the political liberal modus means I have a right to life, liberty and security, and nobody can deny me this right. Reading this article in the spiritual ethical modus sounds different. I have to respect and protect everybody's rights to life, liberty and security, especially of those who cannot defend their rights. From a logical point of view, both statements, both claims are equally grounded. You can deduce it from the general statement. But from a ethical and practical point, it makes a lot of difference to which of both readings we give priority and commit ourselves. Now, the third section is about the role of, the role of economics in a value-driven process of integration. The agenda of responsibility, of the, as a spiritual commitment, cannot be reduced to a new political declaration of universal responsibilities, a new charter. If we want to make a real difference, we have to change the economy. This is an old Marxist adagio, but it is also the way Europe started its post-war process of integration. But how to change the economy? Listen again to Marx. Economic and other changes will never be the mere result of voluntarism and good intentions. They only occur if people, or at least some of its leaders, become aware of the underlying contradictions in a political and economic system. Deep changes do not happen without a strong awareness and analysis of systemic crisis. Only then will voluntarism lead to effective change. In this sense, our financial and economic crisis of today, combined with the ecological crisis or climate crisis, are an opportunity to transform the economy, but it's up to us to see the kairos and of this change. The way we look at the crisis will qualify the way we respond to it. If we analyze the current financial crisis and even the other types of crisis merely in terms of market or governance failures, we will respond to the crisis by some new measures of market regulation and an increase of control on national debt management and budget discipline. Because these measures imply a substantial loss of welfare and freedom, a lot of these discussions will concentrate on the fair distribution of these losses. Who has to pay what? But the point here is that this type of discussion do not question the post-war framework. They do not question the assumptions of economic growth, consumerism, and over-exploitation of natural and human resources. And this is exactly the point if we want to reach a higher level of self-reflection in Europe. We have to look at the crisis, therefore we have to look at the crisis from a broader perspective beyond conventional market and government regulations. If and only if we perceive the crisis as the result of a disordered set or an imbalanced set of values in our individual and collective lives, we will be interested in a process of self-reflection and value transformation. To what extent are we as individuals or as civil society organizations co-responsible for a system of imbalanced values? What are the symptoms and effects of this imbalance? And why are we blind for this imbalance? Are we able to transform the capitalist growth-based market economy from the inside out into a post-capitalist value-based economy? there are some of these challenging questions. Undoubtedly, what a post-capitalist economy is or will be is not yet visible, nor is there any certainty that it will be completely realized. But as an opportunity for a better and more sustainable world, the idea is already present in the mindset of progressive organizations and leaders. They are already aware of the limits of our planetary resources and the conditions of a sustainable world. They realize that it will not suffice to replace the existing technology with green technology without changing the incessant underlying drive towards always more and bigger. If we build green cars, but at the same time stimulate the production and consumption of more and more cars, we will not stop the over-exploitation of our planet. The challenge of sustainability requires both the greening of our technology and the self-restricting of our needs, the self-restriction of our needs. Therefore, we use the term post-capitalism. Whereas capitalist economies are ultimately driven by the highest return on financial capital and may support green capitalism as a profit opportunity, post-capitalist economies are driven by a complex function of value creation that balances spiritual and material values and respects the human condition of future generations. Recent economics revealing the happiness paradox disclose in a contemporary and utilitarian language the old wisdom that more welfare does not correlate with more happiness. The overproduction and consumption of material goods at the cost of relational or spiritual goods and spiritual goods explains the happiness paradox. Up to us to restore the balance. Let's say a last brief reflection on what is needed, in my view here, is that according to the principle of universal responsibility, we need a new perception and management of the common good. And just a brief remark on it. There are different types of good. One type of common goods are the new, are the planetary resources, space, oceans, rivers, forests, climates, internet. There are new global goods. And today they are managed as competitive goods with an expected high return on national investment, and not as global common goods with a high degree of vulnerability. The lack of appropriate management of those global goods leads to the tragedy of the planetary commons, which is already visible in the climate crisis. There is, however, another area of common goods that deserves our particular interest, the area of non-material or spiritual goods such as silence, trust, respect, beauty, wisdom, etc. All these goods share the characteristics of common goods. They are not excludable. When I use that kind of good, the other is not excluded. But at the same time, they are vulnerable goods. Silence can only be maintained if others share it as a public good. If some persons do not respect it, silence will diminish. The same can be said about trust as a very important public vulnerable good. It is important to define the new values of the post-capitalist economy, such as, for instance, frugality, trust, reciprocity, responsibility for future generations, etc. Within this value-based economy, profit and growth are no longer ultimate aims, but elements in a wider set of values. I will finish this reflection here. I just to conclude, Let me conclude with a paraphrase of a nice quote of Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, where he explained what is needed to build a ship. It may put in a nutshell my reflection on a spiritual foundation of Europe. So if you want to build the European Union, don't start with organizing a referendum, or setting up a new commission, or writing a new treaty, but rather teach people to long for a sustainable world that feeds every child. For sure, Europe will be built as a responsible part of this planet, and we will find the right leaders as well.